CTX company. Mr. Vinson.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Josh Vinson. I represent the defendant appellant TTX company in this case, along with my partner Tom Kane. This is an appeal and cross appeal from a roughly $1 million attorney's fee award in a discrimination case brought by 11 African-American female plaintiffs. Each of the plaintiffs received an offer of judgment under Rule 68. These were in amounts ranging from about $20,000 to $160,000. The issue of attorney's fees was left to the district court to decide. As I'm sure the court saw from the briefs, the parties have raised about 20 issues between them. I am going to limit my comments today to two issues that I feel cut to the heart of this case. The first issue that I want to talk about is going to be whether the district court should have made an individualized assessment of each plaintiff's degree of success and the fees relating to each recovery. And the second issue I'm going to talk about is...
This was a four-day hearing on attorney's fees.
Yes, it was.
How long would this hearing have taken? How much more time would have been necessary here to do it the way you think it should have been done?
I don't think any more time would have been taken if initially the fee petition had allocated the fees by... plaintiff.
Well, there's a lot of arguments here about the judge wasn't as precise as he should have been in determining what the hourly fees were going to be for certain lawyers. But 4 days of hearings on attorney's fees just strikes me as outrageous.
It was much longer than I think it needed to be. I agree, Your Honor. The fee petition alone for that work that the plaintiffs were awarded was $70,000. Just on a pro rata basis, that would, kind of points up our argument as to why these settlements represented the cost that TTX anticipated it would be to try the cases. This was scheduled to be a six-week trial. It's 30 trial days. If the judge found $70,000 reasonable for 4 days of hearings on a fee petition, that means the trial itself would have cost $700,000. So I agree. I think it was high. But I don't. When I think you're dealing with 11 plaintiffs, I think that... the fact that it cost $70,000 to conduct that hearing demonstrates that the amounts that were paid in the Rule 68 settlement were a fair measure of the anticipated defense costs in this case. What we're asking the court to do, though, with respect to the individualized assessment, is really nothing more than to apply the reasoning of the cases of Hensley versus Eckerhart and this court's decision in Jaffe versus Redmond. Those cases recognize that when you have one plaintiff who brings multiple claims, the plaintiff's attorney can recover fees even for unsuccessful claims, because the theory is that the effort on the unsuccessful claims contributes to the success of the original, the one claim that the plaintiff has. That's not what happened here. In this case, we had 11 separate plaintiffs with 11 separate claims. They certainly, shared a common employer and asserted the same legal theories, but no plaintiff could recover under a pattern and practice theory individually. We cited a case to the court yesterday that demonstrates that there is no such thing as a pattern and practice claim outside of a class action. So each one of these plaintiffs had to establish discrimination with respect to each of them. They each had to approach it presumably under the McDonnell-Douglas standard and demonstrate that they had been discriminated against. And that means that the effort that was expended on behalf of one plaintiff's case involving her particular supervisor, her particular corporate ladder, the retaliation, for example, that was supposedly visited on that plaintiff, would have absolutely nothing to do with what occurred to the next plaintiff, or the next one, or the next one. They are all 11 separate individual cases. And the plaintiffs themselves recognized this. At the hearing on that fee petition, the plaintiff's counsel testified that they recognized these as 11 separate cases, that they intended to try these cases by dividing up the different plaintiff's claims among the three lawyers that represented the plaintiffs, trying them according to each department in which they worked, according to each decision maker that was involved in each plaintiff's case. And as a result, I think that the conclusion is inescapable that you have 11 separate claims here. And that means that the court really needs to look separately if the court's going to decide whether one particular whether a plaintiff was successful or not. They've got to look at each individual plaintiff's case. You have to look at the recovery the plaintiff made. You have to look at the fees properly allocable to the efforts expended on that plaintiff's behalf. Because if you don't do it, you cannot possibly measure the proportionality involved here on the reasonableness test. If, for example, you have a plaintiff who got $25,000, and just on a pro rata basis, this was roughly $1.1 million fee award, we're talking about $110,000 to produce that $20,000, $25,000 recovery. And I don't think anyone would agree that that's proportional reasonable. No one, no reasonable person would pay $110,000, $120,000 to recover $25,000. And the district court, by aggregating, lumping all these recoveries together and looking at it on an aggregate basis, the court completely missed the fact of how you would have to measure proportionality in this circumstance. And as a result, it creates this, what we claim in our brief, as an illusion of success with respect to 8 of the 11 plaintiffs. Because 3 of those plaintiffs, we concede, made substantial recoveries. But 8 clearly did not. On the continuum of nuisance value to full compensation, 8 of the plaintiffs were much closer to nuisance value. And as a result, the plaintiffs were rewarded on claims where they did not achieve anywhere near full success. And the case that we feel that is most analogous here is the Moriarty versus Vec case, which this court decided in November of 2000, in which the court recognized in that instance a single plaintiff who had multiple separate claims and made it very plain that you cannot use the success on one claim to leverage your success on your lack of success on others. Plain as day. And that is all we are asking the court to do here, is to simply take that logical step of applying Hensley, Jaffe, Moriarty to the circumstances presented here, where there's clearly separate and distinct claims. We did cite a case to the court yesterday as additional authority that demonstrates that the plaintiff's argument that these were somehow pattern and practice claims and therefore all related is hogwash. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there is no such thing as a pattern and practice case outside of a class action, and this was no class action. This was 11 separate cases. The second issue I want to talk about very briefly is what I've sort of titled the may versus must issue. Because the plaintiff's position in this appeal is that we are contending that a district court must reduce the fee award when certain circumstances are present. And that's not our position. Our position is that the circuit court or the district court has the discretion to reduce an award, to even deviate from the factors that this court has said should be considered. But if it's going to deviate and not follow the guideposts that have been established for reasonable attorney's fees, the court has to explain why. Because if the court doesn't explain why it's making the decision that it is, we have no way of knowing whether the discretion as exercised was done in light of proper legal principles.
So when the district court, I think this is a quote, Mr. Benson, says all 11 plaintiffs have received substantial compensation, that's in effect, in your judgment, clear error?
Yes. And the reason is because the district court had no way to make that assessment. There were never 11 individual demands made by the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs always made their settlement demands in the aggregate, and therefore, in saying I looked at 11 separate recoveries, how can you compare what the plaintiffs ultimately took under Rule 68 to an individual demand that was never made? It doesn't add up. It's impossible.
Well, how would you go about that in a hearing then? What would be the structure as you would see it?
As I would see it, the plaintiffs would, in a case where you've got 11 separate clients, just as if I were representing 11 separate clients in a case, even if it was the same litigation, I would record my time separately as it related to each plaintiff's case, what I did in furtherance of that plaintiff's action. There may be some commonality. I'm not denying that. There may be some categories of activity that will overlap, but it has to be allocated along those lines. And then that's how I would submit the fee petition, is on that basis. And once you have the fee petition on that basis, then the district court needs to examine what the amount was that each individual plaintiff recovered under Rule 68 and the amount of fees that the plaintiffs have attributed to obtain that recovery. And then I can decide, is that reasonable or not? I can look at questions like proportionality, which you just can't possibly do on this record. And that's the heart of the problem. The thing that makes it even more difficult, makes the district court's decision more difficult in this context, is the fact that these were Rule 68 settlements. And Rule 68 is a little different animal than when you've had a case that's gone to trial. In Rule 68 circumstance, the case is kind of like in a black box. You don't know what claims were successful. You don't know necessarily, you know, what legal theories would have flown. All the things that get fleshed out in a trial, you just don't know when it's a Rule 68 settlement. So as a result, you have to deal with it, and you know, these are the parameters the court has set, with certain objective criteria. And those objective criteria involve things like the proportionality of the recovery to the fees, the amount demanded by the plaintiff compared to the amount the plaintiff ultimately recovered, the amount paid in settlement compared to what the defendant anticipated its defense costs would be. Those are the only ways when you've got a Rule 68 settlement with no trial and no dispositions on summary judgments here in which the district court can make these sort of determinations. Now, using those as guideposts for making those determinations, we say that that's what creates how the judge makes his choice on that continuum of nuisance value on one end to full compensation or complete success on the other end. You look at the objective criteria, you pick your point on the continuum, all right? And if you pick your point for one reason or another, you got to explain why. And because the time is limited, I want to give one example why there's this problem with the discretion in the district judge's legal analysis here. The district judge decided that these were not nuisance value settlements and that the plaintiff was entitled to full compensation every hour recorded. But on an objective test, we know that the plaintiff's peak demand in this case, 6 months before the case settled, was $4.7 million. And we know that at the time of settlement, the plaintiffs accepted $4.1 million less. There's a $4.1 million drop between the peak demand and the ultimate settlement, aggregate settlement of $600,000. When the plaintiff's attorney was asked at the fee petition hearing, what changed to cause that $4.1 million drop, the answer was, nothing changed. Well, if the judge is going to say, I'm only going to compare the ultimate recovery to what they asked for a few days before they got it, and what the judge called the scaled back demand, the $1.1 million that the plaintiffs asked for a few days before the case finally settled, he's got to tell us why are you choosing to compare it to that $1.1 million demand right before it settled for $610,000 instead of the $4.7 million peak demand that was made just a few months earlier. What's the explanation for doing that? Because it doesn't make any sense to ignore that drop when the plaintiff's attorney has said nothing's changed. So what I'm saying is the judge has the discretion, certainly, to pick the more recent demand. That's what the Tough Racing Products case demonstrates. That was a case involving a trial, not a Rule 68 settlement. So the judge had some good grounds to look. Well, you know, in Tough Racing Products, the plaintiff went to verdict, put his expert on the stand. Expert didn't pan out. The jury didn't buy it. Got a lot less than he asked for. All right, so maybe in that case you compare the ultimate recovery to what the plaintiff's lawyer asked the jury for at trial because the things that developed at trial, changes that occurred. But when you have a case like this one that's settled, not through a trial, settled, and you can look back 6 months from the date of the settlement and see that the demand was nearly $5 million and all of a sudden dropped and the plaintiff's attorney said there was no reason for the change, then I think the district judge is obligated to explain why he's comparing the most recent demand of $1.1 million to the settlement instead of that much larger figure. Because if he can't explain it, then we have to question whether the judge correctly understood the legal principles that were applicable under those circumstances. And that's why I say when the plaintiffs argue in their brief that, oh, no, TTX has this all wrong. This is, you know, they treated it, you know, this is a may versus must issue. District court doesn't have to reduce. We're not saying district court does have to reduce. We're saying he may. and he may not, but if he does not follow the criteria this court has set, the objective criteria for judging the reasonableness of the settlement, then he's got to tell us why. He must explain why. And there's no explanation for some of the things the judge did in this case. Under those, there's no explanation for rejecting outright the undisputed evidence that, that TTX would have spent $610,000 to try those 11 cases. That evidence was unrebutted. Thank you. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent. Mr. Chapman?
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Vincent, Mr. Kane, Mr. Loftus, may it please the court, good morning. I think in 1992 or 3, Judge Cudahy in the Borse case said, if there ever was a case where the discretion of the trial judge should be given great weight, it is this type of case. I think that Judge Evans brought to my mind of a theory that the case was not tried on. That is, that there was to be a separate lodestar for each claimant. That was not the way the case was tried. That never came up before Judge Anderson. For those eight plaintiffs, defendants took the positions that they were not prevailing parties. It was never posited to Judge Anderson that he should make a separate finding for each plaintiff, develop a lodestar for each plaintiff, and then determine what to do. This is respectfully a case where the trial was on one theory, and now Mr. Vincent has presented another theory to the court. It was just not, and if you follow Judge Anderson's opinion, which I submit was a carefully written opinion, he meets those issues which were raised. And one of the critical first issues was the one upon which a defendant relied at the trial, is that eight of these plaintiffs were not prevailing parties. That issue has been dropped in this court, and now a new theory has been presented. Judge Evans, when you raised that point, and having been the trial counsel who represented the Gormans at that hearing, I just wondered how one would do it. I couldn't conceive. This would be the, just as we concerned about Rule 11, then these fee petitions would become a cottage industry in and of itself. I couldn't conceive of what kind of hearing that you would have, particularly when you have a pattern and practice case. This court has consistently held that individual plaintiffs can have a pattern and practice case. The first three counts of this complaint are the individual claims where the common allegations are based on pattern and practice. Defendant never attacked the complaint as being improper, of raising improper issues, and this court as recently as 2 years ago in Adams versus Ameritech in 231 Federal 3rd 414 2000 ruled that you can have individual claims based on pattern and practice. And that's how this case was developed. A great deal of the proof related to pattern and practice dealing with race, sex, promotion, that would have been common to all of them. This was not an issue that was raised in the trial court, but even if you take that this issue is properly before the court, Judge Anderson, in his opinion, did look to each of the plaintiffs. He found each of them to be prevailing parties, and he found each of them had a successful result. Mr. Vincent's closing comments that, well, at one point the plaintiffs were at $4 million, then they were willing to take $610,000. That really belittles the nature of the negotiations. First of all, as Mr. Gorman testified in extreme detail as to the nature of the negotiations, they fluctuated differently, significantly. They involved many different elements. The amount, defendants were low in their amount. They wanted a resignation. They wanted plaintiffs to give up all their benefits. They wanted them to waive all their claims. They wanted to put a cap on the attorney's fees. When the $610,000, including confidentiality order, when the $610,000 offer of judgment was made, plaintiffs, defendant gave up almost everything that they had been asking for, including resignation, a relinquishment of benefits, and waiver of other claims. As we say in a footnote in the brief, while it's subject to a confidentiality order, those other claims were ultimately settled and for significant amounts. So that, and there was no cap on the attorney's fees. The offer of judgment left attorneys. That was a significant accomplishment because that was a premier subject of dispute in these lengthy negotiations, that there would be a cap on the attorney's fees. So the offer of judgment, it's sort of simplistic to say, well, this is just $610,000. Although to me, $610,000 is still a lot of money. And that, you know, Judge Anderson was very close to this case. It's the classic case of why discretion should be accorded such a high deferential standard. He lived with this case. He was a party to the negotiations. He had denied summary judgment hearings. So that, to me, Your Honors, he did all of the things that a trial judge could do. Perhaps he was too lenient, Judge Evans, in allowing the hearings to let the defendant cross-examine at length, to put everything on. And I'm not certainly going to fault Mr. Kane, who was the trial counsel, a very, very fine lawyer for the defendant. We did what we did, and if it went too long, then please forgive us. But we, Judge Anderson, erred on the side of giving everybody a chance to be heard here.
For all those good things you said about Anderson, you're probably not going to tell us that he erred in reducing the hourly fees.
Well, you know, Your Honor, I thought about that last night. Is that it does, when you have a cross appeal of that nature, we've put that out there, is that he did reduce the fees of Ms. Gorman. I thought her proof was kind of very strong, that her billing rates had come to the $325 level. She is an outstanding advocate in this field. We won't comment on him reducing my fee, but that certainly that appeal was taken, but I don't think it's the critical issue in this case. He did, with regard to plaintiff's claims, I think the opinion showed that he evaluated everything, and that defendant has sought to create a very complicated rule of law, which does not exist, to try to take it out of the discretion. In their brief, they take the Farrar case, for example, and say it's a three-pronged level. You have to show, one, you prevail on the merits, two, that it advanced a significant legal theory, and three, was public policy. It isn't what Hensley or Farrar stood for. It was their significant victory. It certainly is not unreasonable. People may differ, but judge, it's certainly within the realm of reasonableness to find, like that Judge Anderson found, that these, each plaintiff was a prevailing party, each plaintiff had a significant accomplishment, and that when he said, I did consider the earlier demands, and I considered the recent one, that's within his discretion. No one of those indicia is the end-all to the case. He considered them all.
Mr. Chapman, what would you say to his discretion to allow the $29,000, at least it appears to me, for the work of unpaid externs that got college credit?
I think there's a difference of opinion as to whether that was it. First of all, Greg Gorman testified on that subject, and he was the first witness, Your Honor, and he said that it was his impression that counsel was seeking compensation for the unpaid interns. When Ms. Gorman got on the stand, she made it clear that they were not, and I do not believe that the only compensation that they were seeking for was for that those that were paid. But I would add this, Your Honor, what is wrong? What would be wrong in asking for compensation for unpaid interns? It's a two-way street. The interns come in to learn. Counsel have their overhead. They have to teach. They have to work with them. it's no difference when defendants in certain cases, well, you've got insurance. Why should we have to compensate you for lost medical expenses for which you were paid? Well, you have to pay premiums in order to get that insurance. That's why we have a collateral source rule. Here, the firm has an obligation to the intern to help teach, to have them come into the office, to pay the overhead allocable to them. So I say, one, I don't believe the record on careful analysis. Mr. Gorman was just wrong, and Candace Gorman cleared that up, and that. But I would say they should have gotten it, but they didn't get it. That answers your question. There, finally, Your Honor, there is the question of jurisdiction for the court to have hear this appeal. As you'll recall, Judge Anderson entered his order in January 2001, in which, to me, it had all the aspects of a final order. Your Honors will look at it, and it concludes, this is the award, this is my findings, this is the amount, and in fact, he puts in a Rule 54 language, where he says there's no just reason to delay appeal, and that within 9 days, counsel filed a supplemental petition for fees based upon time incurred in the hearings on the fee petition. Defendants did not file a notice of appeal until well after the 30 days. Now, I realize another panel of this court denied a motion to dismiss on those grounds, but cited a case from the Supreme Court where all there was a jury verdict, which was incomplete. It said that we fine for the plaintiffs and this and that, and we fine certain damages, but it didn't put in the amount. It didn't purport to be a judgment. Here
there was a separate order, though.
Pardon?
Rule 58, separate order.
Well,
Judge Evans, what was it?
It is an order that was docketed.
Your Honor, it...
I know what it says.
No, but
what
would you want
besides what was here? The order that he ultimately entered many weeks later was exactly the same language, except it used a different numbered form.
I understand. That's one of his technical arguments here.
You don't like that argument?
No.
Okay. All right. We'll move on, Your Honor.
As far as I'm concerned, if you're going to win this case, it's not going to be the jurisdiction.
Okay. And we'll move on, Your Honor. I respectfully submit, in closing, Your Honor, that this is the type of case where what counsel is trying to do is to retry the case in this court on a theory that was not presented, but even under that theory, the judge has evaluated the claims separately, that we would be having trials ad nauseum on the kind of theory that they suggest. It wasn't appropriate in this case. It wasn't advanced to Judge Anderson, but even so, he carefully went through each plaintiff and made the proper findings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. Mr. Benson.
With all due respect to Mr. Chapman, I think we're reading two different records. There's no question the TTX argued for individualized assessment of these awards below. And I would cite to the court docket number 302 at page 20. Quote, plaintiffs did not break down their billing entries by plaintiff and made no effort to allocate their time among the plaintiffs in their fee petition. Therefore, the court should award no more than 3/11 of the reasonable fee. I would also point the court to TTX's brief in opposition to the fee petition and surreply in opposition, and those are docket numbers 306 and 311, where you can see charts and graphs and illustrations depicting the breakdown of the individual amounts recovered by each plaintiff relative to the settlement history of the case. There's no new argument being made here. There's no attempt to recast what occurred below. This was consistently the position that TTX advanced below, and this is the position we advance here. I'm not sure why Mr. Chapman seems to think this wasn't raised below. The record is very clear on that. On the pattern and practice issue, I'm not familiar with the Adams case. I wasn't given the courtesy of seeing that case since it wasn't cited in the plaintiff's briefs, to my knowledge. There is the Babrocki case, I know, from 1985, that is cited in the Lowry case. We cited a supplemental authority yesterday that indicates that this circuit does not agree that there is a pattern in practice in a class outside the class action arena. The point that Mr. Chapman makes, saying that Judge Anderson said he did examine the recoveries of the eight plaintiffs and concluded that the Rule 68 offers represented a substantial recovery to each, as I pointed out in my initial argument, there's no possible way that the judge could have accomplished that. It's physically impossible because there was never an individual demand made for any of these plaintiffs to compare their ultimate recovery to. Mr. Chapman says that we have denigrated the nature of the negotiations that took place in this case by suggesting that the parties, you know, really this was some arduous task to finally, you know, reach the settlement that was reached. I think that the settlement history in this case is highly significant. We are not downplaying that at all. At the inception of this case, the plaintiffs asked for $2.4 million in damages in the aggregate. And after 2 years of litigation, they had their expert witness barred on pattern and practice. They gave up all of their claims for physical and emotional distress damages, which in these types of employment cases is probably some of the most valuable damages elements available to recover. So that was lost. And they never got any relief in the nature of injunctive relief that they conducted like a 4-day evidentiary hearing on. And after 2 years and having those sorts of setbacks in this case, what happens? The demand doubles. It goes from $2.4 million at case inception to $4.7 million. And then in 6 months, it drops to a $600,000 settlement. So I think the settlement negotiations are very germane to what occurred here. I think what's particularly significant is the fact that it took Rule 68 offers to flesh out the fact that this case was fee-driven, that that's what this has been about the whole time. That, you know, once we put the Rule 68 offers out there, that's when the plaintiffs realized, hey, there's a risk that if we go forward and try these cases, we may not get our fees. And they cut bait and took the settlement. Money that was offered that was significantly less than offers that had been made on individual basis before the Rule 68 offers just a few weeks earlier.
The old offers were always contingent on giving up their jobs and all kinds of other things.
Well, that's another important point that I'm glad you raised, because you can only assess the success level of each plaintiff by examining that not every plaintiff kept their job. There were only, I think, three who did. Not every plaintiff had an unrelated claim to this case that they got to retain. I think there were only three or four in that category either. So you can't, again, it's the problem with aggregating these recoveries is the fact that not all plaintiffs kept unrelated claims. Not all plaintiffs had retained their jobs. Not all plaintiffs got bridged pension benefits. A few did. But the only way to determine whether any of them actually made a substantial recovery is to look individually. Yes, one person who got this little bit extra, maybe that's a little more success. We would ask that you vacate this judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.